couple weeks ago, we did an interview with Roger Moody, who helped us look at some of the precursors, some of the signs that maybe the devastation of the tsunami may have actually been preventable. This week, we're going to be speaking with Devinder Sharma, who is based in New Delhi, India. He's a food and trade policy analyst and researches policy issues concerning sustainable development, biodiversity, food security, poverty, and the implications of the free trade paradigm. Good morning, Mr. Sharma.
Hi, good morning.
So I just wanted to start off, since the devastation of last month's tsunami, many environmentalists and many activists are arguing that the staggering death toll could have in fact been vastly reduced were it for stronger environmental protections of the natural ecosystems of the various coastal areas. Many are pointing to mangrove destruction as the primary means by which many communities could have been protected. Are there any examples from the work that you have done of any regions or communities whose intact mangroves you feel actually sheltered it from last month's tsunami and its destruction?
Yeah, exactly. You know, we have found that in the entire Asian region where the tsunami damage was devastating, the damage has been much less in areas where the mangrove plantation or casuarina, the other tree which is important, were intact. And this is not to say that there was no damage at all, but it was greatly minimized. And one of the classic examples is the Marriott Hotel in Phuket Islands in Thailand, you know, which is, as you know, a very strong tourist place. But what happened was because of the peculiar coral structures as well as the mangroves which were required to be there, you know, the government of Thailand had actually very strong laws which didn't allow Marriott Hotel to be up on the waterfront. And so they were quite pushed back, and then they had this shield of the mangrove plantations. And you know what happened? This hotel survived, and the damage in this hotel was much, much less than the devastation caused in the Phuket, along the Phuket beaches. Now, that was one. But if you look at India or look at Indonesia or look at Malaysia and so on, you will find that many areas where the mangrove plantations were intact or were still existing, the damage has been much, much less. And even in Indonesia, an island which was just close to the epicenter of the earthquake, just 40 kilometers away, had the mangroves intact, and only 4 people died in that entire island. And that tells you that, you know, mangroves was a sure wall, a protective wall that nature provided against cyclones, against tsunamis. But because of our the so-called economic structures that we have, or economic thinking, we have actually destroyed them.
Mm. In light of this, how do you think neoliberal economic policies promoted by international trade bodies like the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, in effect, have added to the devastation of last month's tsunami?
You know, what happens is that the economic thinking boils down to GDP. GDP is taken as a symbol or an analysis of growth. And now what happens with GDP is very interesting. If a tree is standing, it is not counted as part of the GDP. If you fell down it, if you cut it down, then it becomes part of the GDP. GDP grows. Now, if that is the kind of model, you know, you can see the devastation that has happened is because of this economic thinking. If the mangroves are intact, it doesn't add on to nation's economic wealth. But if you cut them down, then it adds to economic wealth. I think this is a flawed economic approach. And this means that, you know, if you have shrimp farms coming up or if you have the hotels coming up, then it is economic growth. Now, I think that is what we have paid the price for. Shrimp farms were actually promoted in this part of the areas in the 80s and 90s. And this is called as the rape and run industry. And so they exploit one area, then they move on to the other areas. And when they move into the coastal areas, they bring the brackish water and the brackish farming systems. And in a way, then they destroy the coastal, the natural habitats. And of course, mangroves are the first one to be cut down. And so we have had, at least let's say in India, for instance, 60% of our mangroves were destroyed because of the shrimp farms coming up. And similarly, if you look at Thailand or if you look at Malaysia, Indonesia, much of the damage or much of the destruction to the mangroves was because of shrimp farms. And shrimp farms were promoted by the World Bank and IMF, and of course were also promoted by the FAO. And everybody was very happy. The governments, national governments, all pushed this thing, except that the environmentalists were concerned, the poor farmers were concerned, the poor fishermen were concerned.
what is the process that happens to develop a shrimp farm? Could you expand on what it does to the land?
I think it's two-way. I agree. It's a two-way process. First of all, if I dwell on the other issue, is that, the consumers are also responsible. I'm not blaming the economic system, of course, is one, but the consumers are also responsible, because they were the ones who actually wanted more shrimps to come, and they would always, latch on to shrimps. That, the companies found it very profitable to move on to these areas. So I think consumers should understand also one thing, that they are also responsible for what is happening globally. It's not they're isolated. Having said that, what happens is, when you, let's first see that. Shrimp farming is one of the most, economic growth industry for the world, for this industry particularly. And they have set roots in the Asian region. Now, it all started with the devastation began from Southeast Asia and then came to the Bay of Bengal area. And this industry, when it moves in, because you have to, when you exploit these shrimps from the sea, you want to actually cultivate them or grow them in a natural environment. So then you move on into the coastal areas where you can actually grow them in the farms instead of, you have already exploited the sea. So then you grow them in the farms, which are close to the sea. And that means that you need that belt, particular coastal belt, to have those farms there. So these farms may be, for 5 years or 7 years and so on. That's their normal, period of stay. So then you bring in the brackish water. Then you bring in the species of shrimps, which you cultivate there. Then you add antibiotics and so on and so forth, and the residues then seeps into the soil. That's again a destructive process. And then, of course, you harvest your shrimp and you take them away by the trawlers and so on. But the damage is done in that coastal areas. The companies will move away. So that's why it is called a rape and run. And so these shrimp farms have come along all along the coastal areas. And, in India, for instance, it's Andhra Pradesh, Tamil Nadu, and Kerala to that side, and also some parts of Orissa. They've all been now, of course, having shrimp farms. And look at Bangladesh. Bangladesh, there was a tsunami which struck in one of the areas along the Sundarbans in 1961, and there were the mangroves intact. The damage was almost negligible. And the same magnitude, the tsunami struck in the 1990s, and that was a time when the shrimp farms had replaced the mangroves, and the damage was colossal. So that tells us that, if we have destroyed the natural ecosystems, we are in for trouble. And in a way, I think tsunami has been helpful this time. I hope so, that people realize that, this is what we do. This is the cost that we have to pay when we go for unwanted destruction of natural habitats and ecosystems.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that the shrimp industry, especially in India, has grown in the last 10 to 15 years. Can you give us what's the sort of history of the industry, the shrimp farming industry in India, and how has it been affected by larger policies of the IMF and the World Bank?
When the shrimp industry started moving in the early 90s into the coastal areas of South India, that was a time when the small farmers, the fishermen, began to react to all this, and they put up a strong resistance in India. But what happened was the government, which was talking about economic liberalization, would ignore what the farmers were saying or what the small fishermen were saying. And the result was that the shrimp industry continued to grow while the farmers were being pushed out of farming fishing, and they were becoming landless or becoming jobless. Now, in that process, some people went to the Supreme Court in India. The Supreme Court actually came down heavily against shrimp farming. Now, since the decision came up from the Supreme Court, the industry got together, and then they lobbied with the parliamentarians to see that, this law is not enforced on them. And that is how the shrimp industry in India survived. Although the Supreme Court had actually said that this must stop, and yet the industry was able to manage a way through. And this was essentially one because of the economic policies, also because a lot of politicians in India who are presently in the present government also and in the state governments were in a way associated with the shrimp farms in Tamil Nadu, for instance. And so they had a vested interest. So this works in tandem with the politicians and the economic policies. They go hand in hand. And that is why we have these destructive economic policies being enforced.
I want to move on a little bit to something that you mentioned in a recent article that you had written about the effects of tourism as well on some coastal communities. And you said that whatever is left of mangroves that are cut down for shrimp farming are eventually cut down by the building and hotel industries. Could you expand on this, in particular, how bureaucrats bend and manipulate laws and regulations protecting these regions to allow for
one of the culprits. In this entire game is the Ministry of Environment and Forests of India. You know, these are the places where bureaucrats take decisions which ultimately are actually meant to protect the environment and forests, but actually go against the entire process of protection. Now, one classic example is that in India, they have wonderful beaches, as we know, but many of these beaches were, of course, private beaches. And so there were a lot of campaigns to say that how can hotels be owning beaches? And also lots of industries, as well as mainly the hotels, were coming up upfront on the water, on the beaches. And there was a kind of a campaign as a result of which, the government of India brought in something called a CRZ, means the Coastal Regulation Zone, which means that, you cannot have anything in a space of 500 meters between the sea and, where the hotels would come up. So you had to leave a patch of 500 meters from the sea. But it was the urgency or shown by, or let's say, the blind effort made by the bureaucrats to turn blind eye to the CRZ regulations and allow these hotels to move upfront. And which means that you are actually destroying these natural barriers which would have acted or protected people or communities from tsunami or cyclones. And that was happening one by one in various areas, whether it was Goa or whether it was Tamil Nadu and so on. Now, CRZ is a very, very well thought of regulation, which means that you need to protect your beaches and you need also to protect the natural habitat along the beaches. That was destroyed. In fact, it's very interesting. One sanctuary in Odisha is a very famous sanctuary called Bhitarkanika. Now, this is a sanctuary where the olive turtle, the olive Ridley turtles. This is perhaps the unique sanctuary in the mangrove nestling sanctuary where the olive Ridley turtles come and lay their eggs. Now, the state of Odisha has always been wanting that habitat to be destroyed because they wanted the industry to move into those areas. But that tells us that there was a strong lobby between the industrialists as well as the bureaucrats, which turned a complete blind eye to the laws of protection which were existing within the country.
Are there what are the effects of tourism? You mentioned the natural community. Are there communities of people that are often displaced?
This is a common practice that takes place. A common fallout, I would say, when these industries move on into the coastal areas, and whether it is shrimp or whether it is the hotel industry, and we have estimates. Lots of environmental groups in India have estimated that over a million people have been displaced from these shrimp farms and this hotel industry along the coastal zones.
So, a final question on the tourism industry. Could you just expand on the scale of the tourism industry in the Asia Pacific region and how it's related to the boom bust cycles of some of the industrial developments, such as shrimp farming, that happen in the region?
Exactly. What has happened is, one is, of course, the culprit is shrimp farming. The other one, as I said earlier, consumers cannot escape. And second one is a tourist, because what has happened now is the tourists, especially in the Western countries, for them, Asia is a heaven for, the beaches and so on, for suntan and, all those kind of things. Now, or beach tourism. Now, which is perfectly okay, but they have never realized that what they are doing is actually going to be negatively impacting the rural societies or communities back home in those countries for where they go and enjoy. Now, this is the main reason why, because of the demand from these kind of tourists, the hotel industry would move upfront to the beaches and on the water, facing the water. And that is the result of, the requirement of or demand of people, most of them tourists from the Western countries who thought that all that they have to do is to go and enjoy in those pristine beaches and not really bothering about what will happen to the environment. So I think they're also equally responsible for what has happened. And many of them, of course, have paid the price, as we know. But there has been a boom in tourism in this particular region over the last 5 or 10 years. And this has gone unprecedented, if you look at it. Whether it is Thailand, whether it is South India, I think the only area which was left in a way was Maldives. And Maldives escaped because tourism had not set their base in Maldives. Look at Maldives. Maldives was not very far away from Sri Lanka, whereas the devastation in Sri Lanka was huge. But Maldives escaped by just over 100 people dying. This is because the industry, tourism industry, had actually not moved on to Maldives. They didn't find it lucrative. The result was that Maldives was, dependent upon tourists who came to enjoy the coral reefs, and which means the mangroves had also to be intact. So both the coral reefs and mangroves were intact. And that acted as a shield, for Maldives. So I think that is a lesson which we should learn. People should go for ecotourism, which means you go and enjoy the coral reefs rather than destroying the coral reefs to put up a hotel there. And that should have been the policy. But unfortunately, as I said earlier, tourism growth means a growth in GDP. But, if you cut down the forest and coral reefs, it doesn't add on to the GDP. So I think that kind of economic folly has to be first taken care of.
Are there any discussions similar to the ones that we're having right now about this type of tourism, shrimp farming, and the effects that they might have had on the tsunami happening either in India or in other places in Asia that you have heard of?
Yes, I think one remarkable step that has been taken is the step taken by the Indonesian government, because the biggest destruction took place in Indonesia. And Indonesia has already announced that it will now plant 600,000 hectares of coastal areas with mangrove plants. And this plantation will begin in April. And they are going to spend about 4% of their GDP on this plantation, but they say it is worth the effort now. So I think it's a great lesson that Indonesia, which is, of course, the worst affected, is planning to do that. And I only hope that, the countries like Thailand, Malaysia, and, of course, India, were to also start this process. But to be very frank, the debate in India is not about tsunami now. It's more about the local political situation. People tend to forgetting, except for the donor agencies or the relief agencies working in those areas. The government has actually, I think, washed away its hands and is busy with other politicking.
One final question, kind of a hypothetical one. I wanted to know, we've touched on a lot of the economic issues that are actually at the core of a lot of the things that we've been talking about. And I wonder if you had a meeting with the World Bank President Wolfensohn and could describe to him the effects of mangrove destruction, shrimp farming, and tourism, how would you convince him of their ills?
I think we don't need to do that nowadays. I think we need to stand upfront and tell him that you are responsible for much of the damage from tsunami. I would rather put it up in that way before him, because we have gone too far by being diplomatic and so on, becoming kind, and these people have gone on ruthlessly with their economic policies, which, whether it is agriculture, whether it is coastal areas, whether it's environment and so on, they have been destructive, these policies. And I think we need not be soft to all these fellows now, because after all, it costs human lives, and I'm sure you'll agree, 200,000 people dying is not a small number. And I think it is the high time that we stand up to them and tell them that it is because of you that 200,000 people died. Maybe 50,000 people would have died from tsunami. But, 50,000 people and 200,000 people is a big, big gap. And much of it is because of the policies being enunciated by the World Bank and IMF, which the policies that they back up.
Thank you again for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank
My pleasure.
You. We've been speaking with Devinder Sharma, who is a food and trade policy analyst trained as an agricultural scientist. He is based in Delhi, India, and researches policy issues concerning sustainable agriculture, biodiversity, the environment and development, and the implications of the free trade paradigm.